Chapter 5 Alpha Star Platform, Control Room. Rick L. Cox regained consciousness in stages. First, he realized he was awake. Then he realized he was alive. Then he realized he was in a great deal of pain. He lay on his side, with a tremendous amount of pressure on his body. Something was crushing him, though he couldn't tell what it was. Looking around didn't help. The control room was dark except for a pinprick of light coming from one of the battery-powered emergency lights on the wall. Finding something to push on, Cox forced himself forward, squirming out from under a pile of equipment that had fallen on him. Free of the weight, he took another look around him and tried to stand. Getting up was one thing. Remaining vertical was something else. He took one step and found himself falling and grabbed the wall. At first, he assumed his balance was off, but once he steadied himself, he realized the entire room was tilted over. That's a bad list, he thought, trying to remember how far the Alpha Star could roll before capsizing. With a pronounced limp, he struggled forward, grabbing the emergency light and pulling it from the wall. Pointing it this way and that, he spotted several crew members. Three of the crewmen were dead. Nash was huddled with a crewman named Heaney and two others who were so new to the team that Cox could not remember their names. Neither of the rookies looked able to walk. Anyone else? Cox asked. Nash shook his head. Cox searched desperately for a working radio. The main system was obviously out, but a handheld was found. He dialed in the emergency channel and began broadcasting. Mayday, mayday, mayday. This is Alpha Star Control. We've had a blowout. Rig is on fire. Five men trapped in the control room. Believe the rig is sinking fast. Send all possible help. As Cox waited for a response, sweat poured off his face. They were standing inside an oven and the heat was rising. It's a short-range radio, Nash said. No one's gonna hear it. Unless they're within a few miles of us. Cox knew that, but he had no other cards to play. He tried one more time and then grabbed onto the wall as the rig lurched to the side. The list worsened, but to Cox's amazement, the rig didn't tip over. We've got to get out of here, Cox said. The platform is going to roll before too long. They can't walk, Nash replied. Then we'll carry them. Clipping the radio to his belt, Cox lifted one of the men to a standing position and shouldered the load as they walked. As the man leaned on him, Cox felt his injured leg cry out in pain. It almost buckled, but there was no way he was going to allow himself to fall. He'd pushed too hard and drilled too deep, and he'd probably gotten half the crew killed in the process. If at all possible, he would lead the survivors out of this misery. Nash and Haney helped the second man up, and the five of them moved across the tilted floor. They arrived at a buckled door. Putting all his weight into it, Cox managed to wedge it open. The gap was just wide enough for each man to slip through. Cox began to step through, but stopped. The corridor ahead of them angled downward. Water swirled at the far end. That was bad enough, but when Cox shined the light toward it, he noticed gas bubbles popping as they reached the surface. Go back, he shouted. Everybody back! He pushed his way through the door as the water burst into flame, and a line of fire surged through the corridor toward him. The rush of flames singed Cox's neck as he dove through the gap. Turning around, he saw Nash slam the door shut. It was supposed to be watertight, but the bent frame meant it no longer sealed tightly, and water soon began to trickle in under the sill. We're sinking and listing, Cox said. That's why we haven't capsized. And that corridor is the only way out of here, Nash said. Not true, Cox replied. We can go out through the window in my office. As the tool push, Cox got an office connected to the control room. He didn't do much in there, except sip scotch at the end of the day. But the room had a large window that looked out onto the gulf. Normally, it would be a 60-foot drop to the water. But considering the list and the flood coming down the corridor, the window couldn't be more than a few feet above the water now. Working together, the men crossed the room, thankful that they were heading toward the high side. They pushed into the office and found that all the furniture had slid down against the near wall. The window was on the far side, It was scorched in places and covered in a spider's web of cracks. They could see no daylight through it, only thick, dark smoke and the occasional tongue of orange flame. "So we either drown or burn," one of the injured men said bitterly. Cox doubted they would do either. The fumes were growing toxic. They would pass out and die from smoke inhalation long before anything else. Hoping to avoid all three of those fates, Cox went to the jumble of furniture and looked for something to attack the window with. He would have preferred a fire axe, but all he could find was the old nine iron he kept by the desk, which he used to hit golf balls off the top deck from time to time. He moved back toward the window and swung with all his might. The steel head of the club hit and rebounded, causing little more than a chip in the window. Summoning all his strength, Cox swung again and again and again. He swung until he dropped, but the window, made from multiple layers of high-strength plexiglass, was still intact. "It's no good," he said. "That window is designed to take a direct hit from a 60-foot wave." He sat down, coughing and exhausted. Across the tilted floor, water began seeping under the office door. Nash tried to stand and take the golf club from his boss, but he could hardly move. The fumes had begun to choke them, and the fire in the corridor was consuming all the oxygen. He made only one swing, and then dropped to the ground, his chest heaving.
"There's no air."
The rig suddenly settled further, and the view through the window changed. Half was smoke and fire, while the lower portion was now a blue-green shimmer like that of a dimly lit pool. They would be underwater soon. The only reason the room hadn't flooded was the bubble of air trapped in there with them. Cox knew it was over.
"I'm sorry, boys. I shouldn't have."
His eyelids drooped, but he kept them open. He thought he'd seen movement on the other side of the splintered and frayed window. It looked like a reflection, but it continued growing brighter, coming closer and moving faster. Just as the light got blindingly bright, something slammed against the window from the outside. This time, the plexiglass shattered and green water began pouring in over the sill. The yellow nose of a strange-looking vessel remained lodged there for a moment and then pulled out of the way. Cox recognized it as a submersible, much like the ROVs they used to inspect the pipelines and wellheads. The submersible pulled back, the main hatch popped open, and a figure in advanced firefighting gear climbed out. By now, Cox thought he was hallucinating, but the man jumped into the water, swam up to the shattered window, and allowed himself to be washed inside. Once he'd escaped the torrent, the man came over to Cox. He wore a full-face helmet, but as he spoke, his words came through a small speaker on the outside of the helmet. "How many men in here?"
"Five," Cox stammered. "Five of us." "Who are you?" he added. "Where did you come from?"
"We're with Numa. Our ship is about 500 yards away." "That was as close as we could get. We heard your radio call. Sorry it took us so long to find the control room, but it's not where it's supposed to be."
"Numa? I know a few guys in Numa. What's your name, son?"
"Kurt Austin," the man said. "Now let's move." Cox didn't know if he was dreaming, seeing reality, or already dead, but the room was half filled with water and the fire was burning outside the door. Whether this was real or not, Cox didn't want to miss the ride. He grabbed one of the injured men and helped him through the window into the water. Nash and Haney followed with the other injured crewman, and Austin followed behind, helping them paddle to the side of the submarine, where they crawled aboard and up toward the hatch. Cox helped pull the last man up before squeezing into the submersible himself. There was almost no room to breathe. The small submarine, designed for two men, now held six people, the five who'd been rescued and the pilot. An athletic-looking man with close-cut dark hair and the name Zavala stitched to his jumpsuit pocket. "This will be a short trip," Zavala said, "so I'm afraid we won't be serving drinks." Austin's helmeted face appeared over the hatch above. "Looks like this bus is full," he said. "You guys get out of here. I'll catch the next one."
"You can't be serious," Cox said.
"We got another call," Austin replied. "One of your lifeboats is hung up. I'm going to knock them free."
Cox was glad to hear that at least some of the men were alive, but he doubted Austin's chances to reach them. With that, Austin grabbed the hatch and shouted to Zavala, "I'll be on the south side. Don't forget to come back and get me." "And lose all that poker money you owe me?" Zavala said. "Not a chance." The hatch slammed shut, the wheels spun and locked tight, and the submersible backed away from the edge of the oil rig, turning as it went, and then submerging beneath a wall of fire. To Cox's surprise, the water itself was lit up all around with multiple columns of fire. The flames didn't start at the surface. They were burning all the way down as far as the eye could see. "It makes no sense," Cox said. "Fire shouldn't be down in the water. It just shouldn't be down here." Cox couldn't know it, but Joe Zavala was thinking the exact same thing.